Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net, going strong 44 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we get together in front of our radios to educate each other, inform each other, learn from each other, and entertain each other and be entertained. And I thank you all for coming back this Sunday night when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop as per usual, and I will give you the usual links. If you want to reach me via email, that would be either for mailbag questions for the technical net, or if you have some topic that you would like to share with us that's in the news, science and technology related, or if you have a tech net puzzle, we're always looking at those. They're as rare as hen's teeth. Or if you want me to poke Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA space-related story, of course, you can email him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if you want to email me, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. We have a link page of all kinds of interesting things that I've come across in the last week, and I cut and pasted it into a link page, and it'll be up 24/7 for the foreseeable future. And on the very top of it is an illustration of the great circle that we were trying to discuss the past few weeks. Frank, who's a regular, who hasn't checked in quite yet on EchoLink, but EchoLink was kind of strange the last 2 weeks. So I'm hoping that EchoLink stays stable and Frank's available and other people will share a conversation about the Great Circle. But there's an illustration that hopefully will explain it to people available on my link page, and you can get to that by typing in roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. We have a chat room available. When the room went down, it was very busy a couple weeks ago. Before then, kind of quiet. So if you are interested or curious about the chat room, just type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. We offer an audio stream of the Technical Net and the Glen Oaks Repeater in general. You type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll land you there. And I always like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. He has archived the Limark Technical Net going as far back as September 2006. His site is called amateurradio.tv. He has over a million visitors, so make it a million and one. So that's the links. Let me drop for a second, and I'll come back and tell you what's on the agenda. Okay. We're going to have regular questions. I will ask people to hit their push-to-talk, their first name, and their call sign. That's for questions or comments or topics that they wish to discuss. I would hope that the first few would be amateur radio related. But as the night progresses, we're open to any discussion of any aspects of science and technology. That should take us to about 10:15. Paul WS2N will come and give us the SpaceNet report. That'll take us to 11 p.m., and I will return to put a bow on it and wish you well for the next week coming. Hopefully, we'll be able to get to all that. The repeater will behave itself, and my computers and my shack will behave itself, and, of course, you know I will behave myself. So with all that in mind, let's open it to questions tonight. By the way, no real AI news this past week, so, yeah, nothing much to say about it, just a little bit more of the same. So we're open to questions or topics or comments. Anyone interested, hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign.
That's easy enough to everybody when you have a time.
W2BZ, ham radio related.
AC2GS, anyone else want to put their name on the list? Okay, it's not uncommon at the beginning of the net that people, late to the show or they have other things on their mind, and as time goes on, we pick up other topics. So hopefully we'll pick up a few other topics, maybe even a few amateur radio-related topics. So So, for our first question tonight, or comment, or topic, Rich, do you for tonight?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody else who's listening. My question is a short one, but maybe a complicated answer. What makes a transceiver 50 ohms? That's the question.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question, and I think Dick, K2RIW, used to regularly remind people. It's theoretically, if you didn't really know anything about it, you would say, well, you have to, Andy, WA2CDL, did a talk about how the most efficient transfer of energy is usually when the source and the load are same impedance. And it was decided to use 50-ohm impedance transmission line in coax cables when coax cables became big. And the reason why we got into it before, but I'll just do a quick summation, there is a certain impedance where it can carry the most energy, and there is an impedance where it suffers at least attenuation. The most energy is about 35 ohms of impedance. The least attenuation is 75 ohms of impedance. That's why cable TV coax cables are 75 ohms impedance, because they're mostly interested in the ability to get the longest length of coax cable without repeaters. Us hams, though, are interested in power handling capacity as well. So we cut a bargain and a compromise. We went somewhere between 35 and 75 and came up with 50. And once you've dedicated your transmission line to be 50 ohms, it's probably best to have a transceiver that is able to operate at 50 ohms. So ordinarily, you would think, and I would say, if I didn't know better, that the transmitter stage of a modern solid-state radio is designed to be 50 ohms of impedance. It isn't. If you measure the internal impedance of the final transmitter circuits, it could be a lot of different numbers. The trick, though, is that the electrical engineers design the final transmitter stage to do best feeding into a 50-ohm load. So the transmitter itself is not necessarily designed to be 50-ohm impedance input or output, but it's designed to feed into a 50-ohm system. So when we say that the radio is 50 ohms impedance, it's not really 50 ohms impedance internally. It's just designed to optimally transfer energy at that impedance to the transmission line. So I hope that makes sense.
It makes sense, but you didn't answer the question. The question is, what are the components in a transceiver that make it around somewhat near 50 ohms?
It's the components of value of capacitance, inductance, and resistance. Impedance is a complex number that has to do with the reactance of the capacitors in the circuit versus the inductors in the circuit, and combined in a complex manner with the resistance in the circuit. So any circuit has a certain resistance, a certain capacitive reactance, and a certain inductive reactance. And the total based upon the configuration of those types of components determines the ultimate impedance of that circuit.
What stage of the transceiver? Is it the IF stage? What stage goes into making it 50 ohms?
It's basically the front end of the receiver circuit and the final transmitter circuit for the output.
Okay. So I guess they just fiddle with the values of the inductor. capacitors and the resistors until they come up with around 50 ohms. Now, what makes an antenna like a long wire, an N-fed long wire, the rating that it has? I know it takes, you know, a 49 to 1 or a 9 to 1 transformer to bring it down to around 50 ohms, but since an antenna doesn't have any duct resistors and other electronic components, what gives it its assigned value?
Well, I beg to differ with you, Rich. Antennas are two circuits. They contain, you may not visualize them, but they contain inductors, resistors, and capacitors. The edge effect of an antenna has a capacitive load to it. The length of wire has an inductive load to it. And the conductor itself is not a perfect conductor, and so it has a resistance. So it has all three. Depending upon the design of the radiating antenna, it will present at the feed point with differing impedances. If you take something like a center-fed dipole in free space, its impedance is approximately 35, 40 ohms. As you approach the planet Earth, it goes up a little bit, and so that's sort of where we get the idea that 50 ohm impedance is what you expect. But that's only if you feed it at the center, which is the lowest impedance point of a center-fed dipole, if you could move the center off-center. And that's what happens with things like Windoms. You can bring up the impedance from 50 ohms to 200 ohms, and that's why with some off-center Windoms you put a 4-to-1 balun to bring it back to 50. Theoretically, if you move the center feed of a center-fed half-wave dipole all the way to the edge, theoretically, your impedance approaches infinity. Since fortunately we don't live in a theoretical world, there are some limitations. And so highest that the N-fed half-wave impedance gets to is something on the order of 2 or 3,000 ohms of impedance. So that's why you use something like a 49-to-1 or a 64-to-1 to get it down to approximately 50 ohms.
Okay, so a piece of wire, which is what an N-fed half-wave is, just a piece of wire, has all the properties of that front end of a transceiver. Is that what you're saying?
Standing wave antennas are resonant-tuned circuits. They have their own inherent capacitances, inductances, and resistances.
To me, that's fascinating. You know, if you compare a transceiver that's rated at 50 ohms or around 50 ohms to a piece of wire that also has a rating in ohms, to me, that's just fascinating.
Okay, yes, I could understand you feeling that way. Well, you know, I mean, I mentioned earlier that it was decided to use 50-ohm impedance coaxial cables. You could sort of say the same thing about coaxial cables that you said about antennas. Why is it 50 ohms? Where's the capacitors? Where's the inductors? Where's the resistance? Well, again, there's something called lump circuits, which is a way of looking at a coaxial cable as a almost infinite series of resistances, capacitances, and inductances that cause the coaxial cable to act as a 50-ohm impedance transmission line. So a lot of things will operate as capacitors and inductors and resistance without them being called any of that. When people design ultra-high microwave circuits, they have to be very cautious of how they design the printed circuit boards, because any bit of it can act as a capacitor or an inductor or a resistor, and you could develop tuned circuits in places that you just want to put a wire to connect the actual components. So, you know, the nitty-gritty of impedances and how electrodynamics sort of works all around us is a fascinating subject.
Yeah, I guess I'm just going to have to accept it without really understanding it. Because if you take, well, that's not even a good example. I was going to say, if you take the circuitry that makes a transceiver 50 ohms, and you built a separate, if you took those components out and put them in a box, well, is that what a matchbox does? Remember the old term, a matchbox? Are you familiar with that, Roy?
AC2GS. Yeah, well, a matchbox is just another term for an antenna tuner or another term for a impedance transforming circuit. There are a large number of different circuits, T, L, pi, all kinds of others, that are basically collections of resistance, capacitance, inductance that operate to transform the input impedance of a circuit to a different output impedance. So a matchbox would be something that you would put between your transmitter stage and your antenna to correct for any mismatches and have a perfect connection despite the fact of no longer having a resonant antenna. You're assuming that the antenna, is ultimately, when all said and done, will accept your 50-ohm impedance transmission line. If it's non-resonant, it's going to be off frequency. It's not going to have an inherent 50-ohm impedance, and you're going to have to correct for it. So you use a matchbox or an antenna tuner or an impedance transforming device to do that.
I wonder if it would be possible to make a transceiver have a tunable or variable impedance. So in other words, instead of having an antenna tuner that matches the antenna to the transceiver, you have a transceiver that matches an antenna.
Well, you sort of had that historically, although not exactly the way that you describe it. The problem is, you know, adjusting the impedance of the final stage of a transmitter is problematic. Things have been optimized for those settings. So if you change the internal components, you're going to screw up the fine settings. What happened in the old days, in the present day, it's not that difficult to design a transmitter capable of operating into 50-ohm impedance load because transistors are low-impedance devices. Vacuum tubes, though, are voltage devices, and they operate as high-impedance devices. And so everyone who had the old-style final transmitter stage that was a vacuum tube-based invariably had something like a pi network to bring that very high impedance down to a 50-ohm impedance. So old-fashioned vacuum tube transmitters where you had to tune them up, their pi networks, were kind of variable impedance output transmitters, if you want to fudge a couple of the concepts. But ultimately, that's what those old radios were.
Fascinating. All right, well, like I said, I don't think I'll ever be able to really understand how they do it, how they play around with impedance, but I'll just accept that they do. I'd like to, if I could, change the subject quickly. I read where there's coming some ham radio operators in this upcoming lunar eclipse are going to try to transmit across various distances when, you know, the lunar eclipse is at its fullest. But they didn't mention what frequencies they're going to be trying this at and at what times. Do you know anything about that?
Well, just last week, I think Ryan came by, and he was discussing his interest and wanted to know our thoughts on practical directional antennas that he could take out in the park or something and be part of that experiment. And Paul mentioned something about that. So, Paul, if you're out there, if you can kind of give a short summary of the amateur radio experimentation that's planned for the eclipse.
Okay, Roy. And eclipse, of course, is April 8th, and you want to know the times. Best time for our area is anywhere from, let's say, 1:30 to 3:30 would be a good time to be on the air. And then, you know, whenever the eclipse hits, the exact time is kind of irrelevant. That would be like a benchmark. If you could be on the air, let's say, a half hour or 90 minutes before, a half hour or 90 minutes afterwards to record, not record, but, you know, to log in all your contacts, the information would be by this one particular group, the Citizen Science Group. I get the initial information from this fellow, Ed, WX2R. He did the presentation for Weimar a couple of months ago, all about this event, and very well informed. And apparently people will eventually contact him and send their reports into him using a I get your logging program. You know, then they're gonna take all this information and try to figure out what the story is with the ionosphere. Let me drop it 1 second. And they are gonna use HF frequencies, all the HF frequencies except the walk bands. They will use. You know, I plan on trying 80 meters. I'm always interested in 80 because at night 80 usually, of course, comes alive, and I want to see that happen, you know, because it's during the day, it's a solar eclipse. I expect not to be able to contact anybody before the eclipse, and hopefully during the eclipse, you know, maybe 80 meters would come alive and then should drift away after the eclipse. You know, they want reports on all the bands, I guess, you know, whatever you're on. And they're going to do all the different modes, CW, you know, phone, the digital modes. And if you go to the website, apparently they have information on that website all about this. It's called hamsci.org/eclipse. So it's ham, SCI, you know, for citizen science. .org/eclipse. That's the website he gave out for that. And that's pretty much it. So I'm going to try 80, but I'm sure if you have to get report on all the bands. Anyway, back to you, Ed.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. So, Rich, did you get all that?
I did get all that. Thanks, Paul. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. Anytime, Rich.
Okay. Very good. Let's see. Anyone out there has come up with any questions or topics for discussion tonight? Please hit that push to talk. Yes, John.
Yeah, the previous question, sorry, retain his call sign for memory. I probably should have here every week. Sorry about that. But I don't know if he's got access to the chat room. I put a couple of links there that get into some of Dick's words about this subject, which sometimes I find useful just the way he explains it. If he can get on the chat room, there's a couple of links there, or I could look them up on URZ, and Derek can send him an email.
Okay, I mean, Rich is W2BZ. You can send him an email. if Rich wants, I could send him the links through email, or he could type into his browser chat.acgs.com and look at it himself. You know, those are the options out there, Rich.
Yeah, Roy, if you will, could you send me those links? I would definitely take a look at them right away.
Sure, I'll get them to you sometime during the SpaceNet report. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, John. Anyone else with any comments or questions for tonight? I must say that was the most curiously different audio output I've ever heard on Peter. Let's try it again. I think it might be a John N2 ZC. You know, maybe his echo link is a little wacky tonight, but we'll give it another try.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, November 2, Zulu Charlie. Do you have a question for tonight?
Yeah, I do, Roy. Thank you for acknowledging me, and good evening, everybody. Roy, if you could give a quick explanation of why impedance matching is necessary for maximum power transfer. I was just going through it in my head, you know, thinking of a circuit with a 100-watt light bulb in it, and then if my math is right, that would have 1 amp going through it. And if I put a transformer in line with that, in series with that, and wanted to power a 20-watt light bulb, well, the again, if my math is correct, the 100 watts would have a 100-ohm impedance, and the 20-watt light bulb would have a 20-ohm impedance. That would give you a 5-to-1 impedance matching transformer. What is the factor in there that if you don't match it, you won't get maximum power transfer?
Okay, I wish I had a transcript of WA2CDL's talk on the subject. What you're kind of conflating is direct current circuits to alternating current circuits. Direct current circuits don't have any particular impedances. They have solely resistances because it's direct current, so there's no frequency that's acting on. You know, if you try to run a directed with a capacitor, I guess theoretically you could say, well, let's make it a very, very low frequency alternating current, like an outlet, like the light bulbs and such. And I wish I could give you a simple solution to that. It just seems to me that the concept of impedance is more important as you go up to higher frequency current sources.
Okay, maybe my audio, I know there was a problem with it or I didn't express myself right. Impedance matching AC. AC had a circuit, an circuit powering a 100-watt light bulb, and we had a transformer in there that was a matching transformer. Wanted to power a circuit next to it with a 20-watt light bulb. So, again, I'm thinking, you know, AC, it's a 100-watt light bulb. Would be going 1 amp and have 100 ohms of resistance, and the 20-watt light bulb would be drawing 0.2 and 500 ohms. Now, if we match those, we have one complete circuit for the 100-watt light bulb, and we want to get a transformer power the 20-watt light bulb. You know, I believe, you know, the understanding is you have to have a 5-to-1 transformer in there to power the other circuit. But why is it so critical, you know, you have to get the maximum power, you have to match the impedance?
Okay. If we got any good old electrical engineers out there who would like to explain this phenomenon, if you introduce transformers, you're going to change the voltage and the currents. So, in other words, say you have that 20-watt bulb, If you wanted to have it have the same resistance as the 100-watt bulb, you would need a 5-to-1 transformer, which would effectively, I'm trying to think, where the hell are you going? Where am I going with this? It would change the voltage. So if you took the 20 watt and put a transformer that was a 5-to-1, you would now have, you know, 1/5 the voltage potential. I don't know exactly know where that will get you. So if we got any electrical engineers out there that could answer that interesting question, please feel free at that push to talk.
Well, I don't know about being an engineer. You know, sounds like he's mixing up a little bit power with RF, obviously. They're not identically the same thing, although all the laws apply to both. But if he wants to talk about antennas, maximum transfer to a RF radiating structure, it's going to be very different than a resistive light bulb. Wants to talk about antennas, I might be able to say some words that are helpful here.
Well, yeah, that would be kind of good if we could do that, but that's not his question. You know, sometimes it's always good to kind of adjust the question to the answer. But he's really not talking about that. He's not even talking about transmission lines, because there's a degree of transmission line theory that's involved in utility transmission lines giving us our 60-cycle energy. So his question is kept within bounds of a simple circuit with a source and a load. How do the impedances affect the efficiency of getting the energy from the source to the load? I think it's probably more important the degree of the high frequency. You know, at the lower the frequency is, the less the impedance has an effect, and also in terms of distances, a nearby source load connection is less affected by impedance mismatches than a wider one. So in this particular case, I think it's more of a self-limiting type of situation where you have an effective transmission line between the source and load that's almost zero, and you have a frequency that's very close to zero. So it kind of nulls out the whole concept of impedance matching being highly important in the transfer of energy. That would be my go-to, but, you know, I think that if we change the subject entirely to turn it into an antenna question, it wouldn't be answering his question.
Yeah, you know what? Let's switch it to antenna. Let's switch it and see where it goes there. So if we do a sloppy job of impedance matching the antenna, why is it that we lose the power?
Okay, that's a much easier one. If you remember, I've used this a few times. Some people like it, some people hate it. Impedance is a lot like optical density. What impedance is for circuits, currents, alternating currents, is a transparent medium is to light. In other words, glass, diamonds, whatever is transparent has an inherent impedance in it. And when your light is traveling from the impedance of the air to the impedance of a pane of glass in a showroom, the impedance mismatch produces reflections. This is why when you look in the display glass, you see an image of yourself being reflected back. Part of it is being transmitted. Part of it is being that reflected energy is lost. For all intents and purposes, it doesn't pass the glass. The same goes at the point of the antenna feed. If the impedance from the transmission line to the antenna is not 50 ohms, part of your signal is reflected back at you. It could get into your shack. It could get into your impedance transforming antenna tuner. It can be dissipated as a radiated energy into the atmosphere, but it's energy that's not located in the optimal position that you would want. And also, it would be subject to attenuation loss as it bounced back and forth the non-perfect conductor of a coaxial cable. So that's why antennas operate best at 50-ohm impedance. At 50-ohm impedance, you will not have a mismatch, so you will not have a reflection back down your transmission lines.
You know, I know you said some people don't like that explanation. I like it. I wish well, thank you. What causes this reflection, Roy? What is the cause of that?
And therein lies a real complicated concept in phases and all kinds of things. The effect of a speed of light through a transparent medium is less than the speed of light. Really, internally, as far as the photons are concerned, they think they're going at the absolute speed of light in a vacuum. But the apparent one, because of phase interactions that we perceive, it appears to be going slower than it should. And the reason why it's not really going slower is when it gets to the other end of the glass, it speeds up again. And unless this was just a perceptual problem, you'd have a problem with conservation of energy violations and such. So the medium in which it travels causes phase disruptions that cause reflections. And it gets even more complicated, unfortunately, so I'll spare you that. But I hope it gives you a slight sense of what's going on. Yes, John.
Yeah, I love your, you know, explanation for what's happening in air. Kind of asking about matching, I wonder sometimes, elaborate on what's happening in transmission line and the antenna. That's a little different when we're talking about the electrical waves along the transmission, photon waves that are happening in space. So I could maybe add if you wanted.
Sure, I'd love for you to talk about that. I'm just trying to kind of turn it into the most simple to understand basis, because I think the electrodynamics involved of different electrical impedances in different mediums conducting, you know, alternating currents is a little bit more difficult to kind of simplify, if you will.
Yeah, I understand, but it maybe can go back to the question if he wants to know more about what's happening in the transmission line or not. It's not useful. I don't want to.
No, please. Give it a try. See what happens.
Yeah, so if we think about the simplest antenna that we all know, the dipole, when your signal comes down the transmission line, that antenna, the antenna is not resonant with the frequency. Some of that signal is going to come bouncing back. Why? Because this antenna is in phase when it's the correct electrical length for the signal. Those signals are going to bounce back and forth on that antenna. This is what causes resonance. When those signals bounce back and forth in phase on the antenna, this is what causes resonance. And almost, you know, you can almost think of it like a multiplying effect, that the signal's bouncing back and forth. All the bounces back and forth are in phase, and this is what gives us sufficient radiation. If the antenna is not of the correct length, if it's longer or shorter, it's going to not have the correct impedance, and some of that signal is going to get bounced back down the transmission line. Now, what you have to think about, too, though, is that the entire transmission line, matching network, and the antenna are all part of this transmitting network. So what's the tuner doing? As the signal comes back down the line, hits this matching network, it is re-reflected forward and back towards the antenna again. And this new wave, if you will, the same wave being reflected back, is now sent back in phase into the antenna with the original wave. Does that make sense? I'm paraphrasing, of course, from things I've read. trying to make sure I can say clearly. I guess that's part of the art of explaining things, to be able to put it back into words that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a very good explanation. It's the problem is even though the antenna tuner does shift the phase, there tends to be a kind of a reverb effect where all that energy doesn't just, I think, go directly back in. It tends to kind of partially reflect back out and such. So, you know, everything is kind of non-theoretical ultimately. But I mean, that's a good explanation of some aspects of the reflective nature of transmitted signals into a non-resonant antenna. If you're dealing with a resonant antenna, if you're dealing with a traveling wave antenna, which is a non-resonant antenna, then you probably need to have another description for it, since it doesn't operate on resonant standing waves. But I think it's a very good explanation. What do you think, N2ZC?
Oh, yeah, much appreciated. Much appreciated. So we've, I got a degree in EE, and I've always found, you know, sometimes you need to read 4 books, 5 books, 10 books on the same topic and just get that explanation that worked with you. I don't know if you got anybody else lined up. If not, I would just want to expand on this with one more question on transmission lines.
Sure, Ed. We got time.
Okay, so eventually I'm going to be putting up a beam antenna here. You know, as you know, I moved down to Florida, but that's going to be a little way for so much, you know, home renovation. But I remember in my readings of the ARRL antenna book, they made a case of why some people use ladder line. And if I remember it correctly, and I may not, correct me if I'm wrong, that going long distances, even though when using matching devices you lose some power, if you're going with a long distance, just the pure resistance of the coax is much greater than the ladder line. And when you're thinking of just that in terms, it makes sense then to accept the losses of the matching devices and use the ladder line. I'd like to ask you, I'm going to redo my reading on that, of course, when the time gets near, off the top of anybody's head. Does that sound correct?
Okay, let's see if I can piece this together. Ladder line was the transmission line prior to World War II. It was, although coaxial cables had been designed, the manufacturing was way too expensive for amateur radio operators. It was only after the government invested in a lot of coaxial cables for World War II and then was left with a lot excess and sold them cheaply on the surplus, army surplus, that amateur radio operators went into using coaxial cables. The great aspect of coaxial cables is the inherent isolation from other nearby transmission lines. You can take three different coaxial cables fed into three different antennas, transmitters, go into three different antennas, and you can tie them together in a bow if you want. And the isolation between each of them would not give you a problem. If you tried anything like that with open line, it would be god-awful. But open line has its benefits as well. It doesn't have the isolation, but the attenuation loss of open line is much, much lower than coaxial cables, up until a certain frequency range where they kind of die out and you can't get them to operate correctly. And that's why the design for a doublet, which is a non-resonant center-fed dipole-like structure but not cut to a resonant circuit and corrected by an external antenna tuner, usually calls for an open line, because even though you'll have that reflection back and forth while the antenna tuner is changing the phase of the signal, you won't have as much of the attenuation loss as it reflects up and down, up and down, up and down the transmission line. So open line, the benefit of very low attenuation loss, which could offset the loss of a transforming ballot. So I think that's what you were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it offsetting it. In life, sometimes you get one benefit, but at the cost of something else. So I'm just wondering if there's any thoughts on that. In other words, if I wanted to go, I don't know, let's just say 300 feet of transmission line, from my limited knowledge on the reading, it might be the best way to just come out with the 50 ohms into a matching device and go up, you know, with the twin lead for most of the way, then another matching device for the antenna. Any thoughts on that? Is there a downside to that? I know there's all this talk about twin lead itself radiating. I think that's mostly when it's used, the matching device in itself, but I want to hear what you guys have to say.
AC2GS. Well, a well-designed open line should operate in differential mode and not radiate. If you're going to use it as a stub or something else, then it's a little bit different. But just by itself, it shouldn't radiate. Its downside, as far as I'm concerned, is its lack of isolation. You have to be very wary of where your open line transmission line is going. Is it going anywhere near any conducting material? Because that could screw a lot of things up. Whereas you don't have, no one cares where you put your coax cable. There are some guys on 75 meters who talk about you should have a coil. It should be kind of put in a kind of serpent-like configuration. That's completely wrong. That's inherent lack of understanding of how coaxial cables work. But the open line is very problematic when it comes to its lack of isolation. Now, if you're feeding a perfectly resonant antenna, you should be perfectly fine with a decently designed coaxial cable. Different thicknesses of coaxial cable at different frequencies have different attenuation losses. If you're operating, say, at 80 meters, then, LMR 400 or any of the similar 4/10 of an inch diameter coax cables will not have a great attenuation loss problem if you're going to a tuned antenna. It's when you're going to a vastly untuned antenna trying to correct things with a shack-based antenna tuner, where you're looking to minimize your attenuation losses. So it sort of depends on the situation. If you're feeding into a tuned antenna, then coax is fine. If you're tuning into a decidedly untuned antenna like a doublet, that's where the benefits of the low attenuation loss open line outstrips the conveniences of a coax cable.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, and it also depends on where you're going to have your transmitter. You know, if it's near the wall that you're going to be able to go out, you know, with the ladder line. But, you know, for me, I'm in the middle of the house, you know. My coax goes, you know, down through the floor next to the hydronic heating system. That would be a problem if that was ladder line. And then it follows a couple of 120-volt lines through the basement. And then it runs near some coax cable that, you know, with a bunch of splitters that I have all my TVs hooked up to. And then it follows along and goes out where my heating system is. And I have you've got this 8-inch fluid that goes out. And, you know, that's metal. Some people have ductwork in their house. You can't really do that with a ladder line. So if you're right near the wall where you're going to go through, and then right, you know, you're going to go right to your dipole or whatever antenna you got, yeah, I guess you could get away with the lateral line. But it depends on what your transceiver is. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, that's a good point, Paul. As I mentioned earlier, isolation is a very big beneficial aspect of coaxial cable transmission lines. Yeah, I guess in the old days, most guys did exactly that. You know, usually they were either in the attic or in the basement against a wall that fed into their antenna area, and they were able to get away with it because, running it long all over the house would wreak havoc on everything and everyone. So, yeah, I agree. But, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are more than a few guys who are operating doublets. N2EO, Silent Key, I believe, it liked the doublets a great deal, and he used open line. I think towards the end, though, like some kind of folded dipole type of situation. But, I mean, he was a big fan, I recall, of doublets. Everything is a compromise. It has its benefits. It has its problems.
Yeah, well, when you talk about isolation, I just want to be clear on that. The isolation problem that you're referring to, is it you interfering with other devices or TBI, or is it that like the other gentleman said, if you run along duct, would that interfere with your signal?
It would be both. It's bilateral. It would couple to conducting material, and part of its energy would dissipate into your electrical system. Your electrical system would couple into that, which I'm sure wouldn't really help your transmitter stage if a high voltage source all of a sudden popped into it. So it's kind of a bilateral disaster.
Okay, very good. I'll look into it more. Like I said, when the time comes through my reading, and you guys gave me some good feedback. Thank you as always, and I'll turn it back to Ned.
Okay, thank you very much, John. Always appreciate your participation. This continues to be AC2GS and the Limark Technical Net. Anyone else with any questions or topics for discussion tonight, please?
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. I am Charlie, and I'm listening because I'm learning a lot.
Okay, Charlie, good to hear from you. I hope you write this all down. Put it someplace safe.
Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Lima Papa.
Yes?
Hi, name is Ivan. I have a question about magnetic loop antennas.
Okay, Ivan, what pray tell, what is it?
So, I'm in a very tight situation here in Forest Hills, Rego Park border. No outdoor antennas. I might have mentioned it. So, not even on the AC unit. So, I got this Chameleon Loop 3 magnetic loop antenna. The way I was researching it, and I'm new. I've only been licensed for 2. So the catch was, so it's a magnetic loop antenna. It does not, it works differently from wire antennas in by which it transmits magnetic field, radiates magnetic field rather than electric field. And so it wouldn't be an issue sort of in urban, best fit for indoors applications. I've been kind of disappointed trying it for the past 3 days, and my SWR is through the roof. It's like 3+ something. I get it lower on 10 meters. I was lucky with 15 meters, but nobody hears me. And again, I'm not putting out more than 21, but still, even locally. And I'm thinking magnetic field radiation. Is this a subject to kind of, I live in a Faraday cage on top of it all, too, because it's an old apartment. It's the wire mesh with the plaster, all my walls and ceilings, all like that. So I pointed to the radiating pattern towards my window. It's right at the window in my kitchen. So I'm thinking I should have, I should get somewhere because it's radiating, east. Any advice or kind of educational tips on how to go about magnetic loop antenna things or little tricks that would help to alleviate the conditions that I'm having right now.
Okay, well, let me start at the beginning. You mentioned that you orient your magnetic loop. How would you describe the way that you are orienting your magnetic loop? As opposed to, let's say the zero angle is looking through the big donut hole. So what angle are you presenting to the window?
So I was thinking that, well, the way the paperwork shows the radiating patterns with the antenna. So if you're looking at the loop, in the plane of the loop, those are just sharp knobs. So only sides of the loop radiate, basically. So I turn the knobs towards my wall. So there's nothing radiating that to the walls and to another wall on both sides of the loop. And the side of the loop, so if you're looking at my antenna, it's facing the side of the loop is facing the window directly out almost at the window, while the nulls are in between the walls.
Okay, very good. That's the right answer, because a lot of people kind of look at loops and they kind of like to think that the radiation is kind of going through the donut. It's going at a 90-degree angle of the donut. But it's really not all or nothing. It's not a binary radiation pattern. So I think the extreme, the directions and instructions kind of suggest that magnetic loops are kind of bidirectional. Both sides and nothing out the front. Nothing in the real world is kind of zeros and ones. They're fractions. They're percentages. So there's some things going on in the middle, even though it says it's a null point. It's a relative null point. It's a low radiation intensity compared to the sides. So pointing it at the sides is the first good thing to do. And I have the same type of Faraday cage environment. My house is made with chicken wire and plaster as well. And it when I set up a magnetic loop receiver in my shack just to test it before I took it out, it was abysmal. I had to take it out because inside it was pointless. And the aperture of my window was probably not big enough to get anywhere. Another thing you have to understand, unfortunately, that we talk about compromises, pluses and minuses, and I've mentioned in the past, I'll mention it again. The problem with magnetic loops is that they tend to be rather inefficient. They tend to be a little bit more efficient the higher you go with its resonant range, because it's a function of how much capacitance you have to add to it and other factors. So 10 meters, you get a decent chance. But none of them are really highly efficient antenna designs. So the good is that you can put it on the ground. You don't have to worry about the elevation. But the bad side is that there are much more efficient antenna designs out there. I'm not exactly completely familiar with chameleon magnetic loops. Do they allow you to adjust the position of the inducting coil, the smaller coil on the magnetic loop?
The particular model that I have right now, it's got two aluminum radiators, the primary loop, the big one, 3 foot in diameter. The radiating elements are 1 inch thick. It's hollow inside, but apparently it's all about the skin effect with magnetic loops and the surface area. And the lower, or the secondary loop, 7 inches wide, and it's right underneath the inside and in the plane of the primary loop, quarter inch apart, because they're not, according to the instructions, they're not supposed to touch, so leave a quarter inch distance. It's mounted in the plane of the radiators, and it's fixed. Once you put it, set it all up, put it all together, that's the construction and the contraption you're going to have for the duration of your operation. I mean, I can always tinker it if I know how and what to do. I could probably use some different mounting methods to just write. I knew what I got to do. But that's